Okay then, brethren, there were a number of things I wanted to talk about. Several came along all at once, and I thought, well, should I talk about this, or this, or this, or this? And I thought, well, I'll talk about four different things today. So I've divided today's Bible study message into sort of four parts. And the first part is looking at a potentially prophetic event that took place very recently, just over a week ago. Then I want to just quickly recap very, very briefly on last week's discussion about whether if we're looking for prophecy fulfillment, we should be looking at Europe or looking at Islam in the Middle East. Then I want to look equally today, part three, we'll be looking at the book of Daniel, but does Daniel actually cover the key gospel message of Jesus Christ? Not just technical prophecy, but the actual gospel of the kingdom. And then fourth, we'll move on with our more general discussion about prophecy and the book of Daniel, today being about Daniel and the four beasts of Daniel chapter 7. So sort of four different segments. The first segment is looking at a prophetic update, or I should say a potentially prophetic update. If you're looking towards Jerusalem and the Middle East and the Arabs and Islam, you might have noticed just a week ago, just over a week ago, quite a significant major political development. Mr. Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, announced on the 13th of August a new peace treaty, a very significant peace treaty between Israel, Jerusalem, and the United Arab Emirates, one of the Gulf Arab countries. And this is significant in quite a number of ways. There have only been, since Israel began as a nation in 1948, two previous peace treaties, one with Egypt in 1979, one with Jordan in 1994, just a quarter of a century ago, and then last week's with the United Arab Emirates. Now we'll look at that more in a moment, but first of all, at enormous expense, we have invited Mr. Donald Trump to come in and just give us some of the brief details of this historic announcement. This will last about a minute.
Just a few moments ago, I hosted a very special call with two friends, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed of the United Arab Emirates, where they agreed to finalize a historical peace agreement. Everybody said this would be impossible. And as you know, Mohammed is one of the great leaders of the Middle East. After 49 years, Israel and the United Arab Emirates will fully normalize their diplomatic relations. They will exchange embassies and ambassadors and begin cooperation across the board and on a broad range of areas, including tourism, education, healthcare, trade, and security. This is a truly historic moment, not since the Israel-Jordan peace treaty was signed more than 25 years ago has so much progress been made towards peace in the Middle East. By uniting two of America's closest and most capable partners in the region, something which said could not be done, this deal is a significant step towards building a more peaceful, secure, and prosperous Middle East.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Trump. As you probably noticed, that was actually the White House, not our house. Well, like Mr. Trump says there, this is actually a major historic event. There were these two previous peace treaties with Egypt and Jordan, but in many ways, they're quite at a much lower level than this particular agreement with the United Arab Emirates, the UAE. I'm told if you go at the moment to say, Egypt or to Jordan and ask what the local people, the man in the street, thinks about the Israelis, the Jews, is fairly sort of negative. Not huge amount of affection between them, right? Because in reality, those countries, whilst at peace with Jerusalem and Israel, they're not having normal relations. But Mr. Trump says there, the idea of the accord with the UAE is to fully normalize. They're talking about embassies, They're talking about direct flights, talking about tourism, trade, education, health, also security, quite important in that part of the world. All right, so this is a very different animal to the one in Jordan and Egypt. And of course, the Israelis can then say to the Arabs from the UAE, a Muslim country, hey, you want to come to Jerusalem and come and visit the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest shrine in Islam? Come on. We've got normal relations now. This is a very different beast to what we've seen sort of before. It's actually referred to as the Abraham Accord, this peace treaty, because Abraham is, of course, an important figure to Christians, Jews and Muslims, Abraham the patriarch. As to why it's come about, well, I think probably two good reasons. One is the Arab countries, it seems, in the Middle East have got a bit of fatigue. They've been trying to look after the Palestinian cause for decades, since 1948. Zero progress. 70 years, no progress. The Arab countries have poured billions into Palestine for the Palestinians, and they get nothing to show for it. So I think essentially they're fed up. Lots of Arab countries want to move on to a new peaceful world with trade and wealth and prosperity. And the Palestinians, if they're not careful, will be thrown under the bus. So fatigue is a big reason for the UAE being the first Gulf state to take this decision. The second reason, I think, is also very important, which is that lots of Gulf states do not trust Iran. They're very nervous of Iran, whom they believe is run by nutters, fanatics. And the UAE is nervous about Iran. And anybody who makes friends with Israel gets quite a strong friend in the region. The Israeli military is super strong. The Israelis probably have nuclear weapons. So making friends with the Israelis, potentially a good idea. And if you're friends with the Israelis, it probably improves your standing with the United States of America, the world's only superpower. So some good reasons for that. Mr. Trump said it's historic. He's right. Absolutely historic. If you ignore the much lower level agreements with Egypt and Jordan, this is the first big, full-blown, normal relations with an Arab country in the Gulf. Absolutely historic. Is it prophetic? Well, it's always hard to tell ahead of time, but I would say potentially very prophetic. Now, we're going to show you a map, I think, at this moment, just so you can see where the UAE is in that part of the world. You'll see it down at the bottom of the map on the Persian Gulf area. You'll see just north of it, Iran, just over the water. You'll see to the west, Saudi Arabia, Iraq. In the north, to the left, you'll see Turkey. Busy part of the world. And the expectation of Mr. Trump is that other Gulf nations are probably going to follow in the UAE's footsteps. And this past week, I've seen Bahrain, Oman, and Sudan all mentioned as possible states to make peace with Israel. Okay, so I guess if you're watching the Middle East and Islam, yeah, continue to watch. This has changed the dynamics of the Middle East significantly. Okay, so that was part one, our sort of prophetic update. Part two is our recap of last week when we were looking at the whole issue of, in terms of being people who watch prophecy and following the signs of the times, should we concentrate on looking at Europe and Germany and the Vatican? Or would we be better to look at the Middle East and Jerusalem and the Arab countries and Islam? And I've said, well, why do people look at Rome and Europe in the first place? It's been a very popular place to look, of course. The idea that Europe and the Holy Roman Empire will return goes back a long, long way. Hippolytus, the Bishop of Rome, presented that idea in his commentary on the Book of Daniel way back in 200 AD, right? And as far as I can make out, the belief that Europe of 10 nations, 10 dictators, in some sort of a liaison with the papacy in the Vatican, that appears to go back to Daniel chapter 2. It's recovered last week. You got the statue of the gold and the chest of silver and bronze and the legs of iron. And it appears to be that the idea of the Roman Empire and the resurrected Roman Empire goes back to that statue and the interpretation of what the prophecy means. What I said last week is, quite honestly, if you use the Bible as your sort of measuring stick, Rome fails the Bible test. Let's turn to Daniel 2 and verse 40. Just look at the one verse from last week. So you've got the statue that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream. You've got the legs of iron, and you've got stone comes out and smashes the legs, and then the whole statue topples over, and the wind blows it all away in pieces, and the stone grows and becomes the kingdom of God. Daniel 2:40, Daniel's interpreting, and he says, "The fourth kingdom," this is the iron legs, "shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things, and like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others." Okay, the Bible test tells us that the fourth kingdom, the fourth empire, the legs of iron, will break in pieces and crush all the others. Right? So all we're going to do really is say, well, did Rome do that? Did the Roman Empire break in pieces? The word break in pieces in the Aramaic is dekaq, D-E-Q-A-Q, which means to smash, to smithereens, to pulverize, to reduce to fragments. Did Rome pulverize, smash to pieces, fragmentize the ones before it? And the answer is, well, no. Rome never defeated Persia, which was the second empire, the chest of silver. And Rome, whilst it defeated the armies of Greece, it never smashed in pieces and pulverized Greece. In fact, the Romans, you know, had a great affection for the culture, the plays, the literature, the gods, the goddesses of Greece. Greece was still a language. Even through the days of the Roman Empire, most people spoke Greek. So actually, in my view and other people's views, Rome utterly, abjectly fails the Bible test. Right? Simple as that. We also looked last week briefly at Revelation 17, which I'm not turning to now, but that was the reference to this great harlot sitting on seven mountains. Right? And if you remember, the story is that somehow the seven mountains become a city on seven hills, and everybody knows Rome is a city on seven hills. Therefore, the harlot sits on the city of Rome. And the harlot, clearly a polluted church, must be the Catholic Church. And that's sort of how it goes. Well, what did we say last week? That's almost an example of confirmation bias. You already believe it's Rome. There are seven mountains. I'll just quickly, nobody's looking, call them seven hills. And then the city in seven hills clearly is Rome, so I'm proving the point I already believe. It's not how it works. Right? A bit like when you see the statue of Nebuchadnezzar. Well, there's two iron legs. Clearly, the Roman Empire divides into two. One leg is the Western Empire, and one leg is the Eastern Empire of the Roman Empire. So again, proof positive, it's Rome. To which I'll ask two or three questions. This is a statue of a man. A man has two legs. That's why it's got two legs. It's because it's a statue of a man. All right? It's also got two arms. What do they represent in Persia? It's got two nostrils, two ears, 10 fingers. What do they represent? The answer is, it's a statue of a man. Of course it's two legs. And by the way, if you read Daniel 2, or look at some of the artist's impressions of the statue, you'll find that it splits at the thighs. The two iron legs are from the knees down. The belly and thighs are of brass. So there's two thighs. You need two thighs, you get two legs. So what do the two thighs represent in the Greek Empire? The two arms of the... Looking at this, must be the East and West Roman Empire. Again, you're clutching at straws. It's confirmation bias. You're reading into the scriptures something that's not there. When it gets to the seven mountains of Revelation 17, if you want seven hills in a city, well, you get quite a wide choice. San Francisco, don't be facetious, Jamie. This is talking about Bible and Bible places. Well, okay then. Jerusalem is seven hills. Why not Jerusalem? Why is that not the city on seven hills? What about Istanbul? Istanbul's a city on seven hills. Why not choose that? What about Mecca? Mecca is the beating heart of Islam. Mecca is the city to which all Muslims, pray several times a day. If you're a Muslim and in good health, you're required to make a pilgrimage at least once in your life to Mecca. Mecca has seven hills, so why? Right? But of course, the answer is Revelation 17 doesn't talk about seven hills. It talks about seven mountains. Mountains representing in the Bible everywhere a kingdom or an empire. And it tells us five have fallen. What is and what is yet to come? Well, what sort of city is Rome sitting on? One hill, because five hills have left and there's one hill still to come and it's only sitting on one. The whole thing is really, I don't want to be, rude. If you don't believe that, they're fine. But I have to ask the question, if you believe the Fourth Empire and the End Time Empire is a Roman Empire, resurrected again and again and again over the last 2,000 years, is that based upon hard, solid Bible, or is it based more on tradition, on familiarity with the idea over perhaps many decades, like in my case? I believed that all through the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, noughties, right? So I'm in a good company. Lots of people believe that. But is it based upon tradition and what we've been taught rather than coming straight from the Bible? I think the answer is probably yes, in many cases at least. And you may say, as I would have said if you challenged me 10 or 15 years ago, well, hang on a second, Mr. Armstrong taught this. Worldwide Church of God taught this. Radio Church of God taught this. And I have high regard for the teachings of Mr. Herbert Armstrong. So therefore, if he taught it, then I'm going to believe him.
Rather than you.
That's a possibility, obviously. But I personally differentiate between Mr. Armstrong's clear teachings on Bible doctrine, Sabbath, quite clear, the Holy Days, quite clear, Mr. Armstrong's teaching that God is Father and the Son, not Trinity, pretty clear, Mr. Armstrong's teachings that there's no immortal soul, that Christmas and Easter are pagan, tick, tick, tick. So I differentiate between Mr. Armstrong's qualities as a teacher of Bible doctrine and his interpretation of Bible prophecy, which really wasn't too good, right? Now, Mr. Armstrong was converted, of course, in the late 1920s. He came to his understanding of prophecy in the 1930s, which was, of course, a very interesting time, the Great Depression, but also building up in 1930s, you had a lot of stuff in Europe, the Nazis. And, of course, leading up to the Second World War, which was a horrifying time, to live. And I think, in many ways, giving Mr. Armstrong the benefit of the doubt, he was very much influenced by the times he lived in. Because, they were awful times. You quite easily could have thought, this is it. This is the end of the world. Must be. The whole world is at war. How can we even survive? So that's the time that he came to his interpretations of prophecy. So I've got a few quotations here. We're going to put it up on the screen so as you can see as I sort of read along. But here's Mr. Armstrong's sort of views. I'll take the first one. It's from the March 1938 Plain Truth. Mr. Armstrong says, Mussolini, that was the fascist leader of Italy, Mussolini and the Pope will hatch up an idea between them of setting up a world headquarters at Jerusalem. And so Mussolini's armies will enter Palestine as per Daniel 11:41 and eventually will capture half the city of Jerusalem. He's referring there to Zechariah 14:1. So Mr. Armstrong's view of Daniel and Zechariah is Mussolini and his armies. Right? Wrong. The January 1939 plain truth, still a few months before the war began in Europe, and long before it began for you Americans, but the war began in this country in September 1939, a few months later. But at that point, Mr. Armstrong says, Mussolini's soon appearing reborn Roman Empire is the beast power. And Mussolini undoubtedly is the beast. With prophecy, it's difficult to use the word undoubtedly, because I think it'll come back and bite us in the behind all too often. But there he says, Mussolini and his reborn Roman Empire is the beast. Mussolini undoubtedly is the beast. Well, he wasn't. And carrying on in the same issue, undoubtedly then, the beast who'll be fighting at Armageddon against Christ is Mussolini, with 10 European dictators and their armies. It is coming in this generation. Well, that's 80 years ago. That generation is long dead. And then the May-June 1941 plain truth, so I guess that's actually before the Americans joined the war. I think that was December 41 with Pearl Harbor. So at this stage, Mr. Armstrong says, and he's looking across, you know, the Atlantic at Europe, and all the nations fighting and squabbling and so on. He says, Hitler now emerges as the beast of Revelation, meaning the book of Revelation. So Mussolini, 2 years earlier, is the beast. Now Hitler's obviously the stronger, more powerful, more authoritarian, more totalitarian. So now Mr. Armstrong says, clearly, undoubtedly, Hitler is the beast. Well, he wasn't, right? And then jumping a few years ahead, August 1952, plain truth, Mr. Armstrong says, Adolf Hitler probably is still alive today. Evidence piles up that he is this minute secretly directing the powerful Nazi underground, right? Well, no. Now, to be fair to Mr. Armstrong, in the early 1950s, many people thought that Adolf Hitler and other top Germans had seen the end of the war coming and had sneaked off using submarines and other vessels and disappeared with great wealth to other places. Argentina, for many decades, was considered a second home for former Nazi Germans, and there's probably a lot of truth in that part. But here you can see that Mr. Armstrong was saying here that this very minute, in 1952, Hitler is personally directing the powerful Nazi underground. Well, of course he wasn't. If he was, it's all fizzled out, you know, 70-odd years ago. So you cannot question Mr. Armstrong's sincerity in terms of his understanding of prophecy. You can't really question his urgency, right? But his interpretation, looking to Europe, to Mussolini, to Hitler, it's not based upon the Bible anywhere. So I would say that Mr. Armstrong was coloured by his experiences of World War II and the lead into it. And he was coloured because any commentary he looked at about Daniel or Revelation would have said, Rome, 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 Rome. So that was the world he was living in. My opinion, but it's not really speculation. My opinion is if we go strictly by the Bible and just say it has to pass the Bible test, then Rome has very, 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 very little support. I would say none. But if you want to believe there's some there, that's fine. Islam, I think we'll find, is a far better fit. So that's two parts for today. Prophecy update and brief recap of last week. Part three is talking about Daniel and the Gospel of Jesus Christ. Because we've said already a couple of times that Daniel is the manual for the end times, right? The book of Daniel is really a manual. There's lots of details in Daniel that pertain to the very last days, to the end times, much more than I used to think. So it is essentially a manual we can use to take us through the end times. But it's not just a book of, if you like, technical prophecy, right? The book of Daniel itself is referred to many, many, many times in the New Testament, but obliquely, in a sense. You don't always see it sort of in your face, because Daniel actually contains the central message of the gospel of the kingdom, in addition to being very prophetic, right? We'll have a look at that now, just for a little bit of a diversion. Let's open to Daniel 7. I'm going to read verses 9 and 10 to begin with. Daniel chapter 7. So we've had the four beasts, which we'll be looking at in a few minutes, but right now we just pass those by and we come in at verse 9. Daniel says, "I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated." That turns out to be God the Father, the Ancient of Days. "His garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, its wheels of burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000,000 ministered to him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated and the books were opened." So here's the Ancient of Days, God the Father, with hundreds of millions of angels sitting down, and a judgment is about to take place. These books were opened. We might come back to them later, okay? Because an important event is about to take place. Now, actually, in my inspired marginal reference, I don't know if you can see it, it says there in the inspired marginal reference, "This is the great white throne judgment." Well, of course, it's not. That's just me sticking nonsense in my margin. I think it came from an old Ambassador College or Worldwide Church of God article. It's got nothing to do with the white throne judgment. That's just showing you that I put nonsense in my Bible from time to time. So we got the Ancient of Days sitting there, a judgment about to begin. And let's drop down to verse 13. "As I was watching the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven, he came to the Ancient of Days. And they brought him, the Son of Man, near before him," the Ancient of Days. "Then to him," the Son of Man, "was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples," plural, "and nations and languages," plural, "should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed." So what you've got here is the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven to be presented to the Ancient of Days, the Father, at which point clearly he is given an everlasting kingdom, right? And given authority over nations and tongues and languages and peoples. This is the coronation of the Lord Jesus Christ by the Ancient of Days, at which point he's given the kingdom, right? Let's carry on and just look at verses 25 to 27. Verses 25 to 27. He, talking of the little horn on the fourth beast, which we'll come back to next week probably, "but the little horn shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute or harass the saints of the Most High, shall intend to change times and law," right? "The saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time," 3.5 years of persecution and martyrdom, I'm guessing. Verse 26, "but the court shall be seated. They shall take away his dominion," the fourth beasts, "to consume and destroy it forever. Then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. So here, actually, if you want to look at it this way, you've actually got the gospel of the kingdom of God. You have the Son of Man, register that word, the Son of, or that phrase, the Son of Man comes to the Ancient of Days on clouds, receives a kingdom at the time of the fourth beast, and that kingdom is shared out over the whole world and among the saints of the Most High. That is the gospel of the kingdom of God, right? And you find it here in the book of Daniel, chapter 7. And there's frequent references back to this description here, the story here, throughout the New Testament. Now, let's look at the term Son of Man for a moment. The Son of Man is a phrase that Jesus most commonly applied to himself. That we might think, well, you know, Son of David, Son of God. No, the term that Jesus used for himself most frequently is the Son of Man. He used it over 80 times in the Gospels. Quite a lot. That's his preferred title. I am the Son of Man. And it does not mean I am a human being. You might think, well, it just means I'm a son of, you know, flesh. I'm a fleshly person. I'm Jesus, the fleshly person. No. Not at all. When Jesus says, I'm the Son of Man, he means I am the divine being of Daniel chapter 7 who came on the clouds of heaven to the Ancient of Days to receive rulership over the world. I'm that person. I am the divine being of Daniel chapter 7. To make that claim is, to many people, controversial, right? I'm a divine being. Well, you and I know that Jesus is, but in his day, walking on the earth, did people believe that? You know, let's turn to Matthew 16, look at a couple of places where Jesus uses this expression, Son of Man. So Matthew chapter 16, what's often referred to as the Great Confession, beginning in verse 13 through 20, I guess. When Jesus came into the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? That's Jesus' expression for himself, for a good reason. And so they said, well, some say you're John the Baptist, some say Elijah, others Jeremiah, or one of the other prophets. He said to them, but who do you say that I am? Simon Peter answered and said, you are the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Jesus answered and said to him, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. To notice that I am the Messiah, the Son of the living God, fantastic. Also I say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. The gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. I will give you, singular, the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. And he commanded his disciples that they should tell no one that he was Jesus, the Christ, Jesus, the Messiah. But this whole great confession is built upon, who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? Jesus, being the Son of Man, is key critical, and it doesn't mean I, a human being. I am the Son of Man. You know the one. Look at Mark 14. Let's read verses 55 to 65. So Mark 14. Beginning in verse 55 through 60. This is on the night Jesus is arrested after his final Passover. So he's in those hours leading up to his crucifixion, and he's taken off initially to the chief priests and so on to be interrogated. Verse 55, and the chief priests and all the council sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death and found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimonies did not agree. Some rose up and bore false witness against him, saying, well, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I'll build another made without hands. But not even then did their testimony agree. And the high priest, you know, top authority, stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you? But Jesus kept silent and answered nothing. Again, the high priest asked him, saying, Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? Which, of course, the apostle, or Peter at least, had just acknowledged, right? You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Here the priest asks Jesus outright, Are you the Christ? You know, the prophesied Messiah, the Son of the blessed God. Notice what Jesus replies, I am. And then notice, And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven. Almost quoting verbatim Daniel 7:13. Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, What further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. Blasphemy? Yeah, because Jesus is saying, I'm the divine being of Daniel chapter 7. You've heard his blasphemy. What do you think? They all condemned him to be worthy of death. Some began to spit on Jesus and to blindfold him and to beat him and to say to him, Prophesy. And the officers struck him with the palms of their hands. So the reason for the reaction here is when Jesus says, I am, and you will see the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven, the one who sits at the right hand of the power, the Ancient of Days, that blew their minds. Jesus saying, I am the divine being of Daniel chapter 7, the one who's going to come and rule the whole world, all kingdoms and tribes and nations and languages. That's me. They couldn't take it because they understood what verse 62 means, right? So I think, you know, sometimes, you know, we just miss things like the Son of Man. When Jesus says, I'm the Son of Man, he doesn't mean I'm a human being, right? He means I'm the man that you'll find in Daniel 7, who will govern the world sometime soon, right? Let's turn to Matthew 24 and read verses, I'll start with 3 and 4. So Matthew 24. What I was going to say is that if you read the Gospels in particular, even other places with this in mind about Daniel 7, the gospel of the kingdom of God, the Son of Man, the clouds of heaven, you'll see it quite a lot of places, which makes me think those people that ignore the Old Testament, you know, I've seen people just have the New Testament. I've got one myself. So I've got two, I think. Just the New Testament with Proverbs and Psalms, because they're okay. Psalms is lifting and Proverbs is theoretically wisdom, but you don't need the Old Testament stuff, Chronicles and Kings and stuff. Leviticus and sacrifice and blood everywhere. Oh, yes, the New Testament. Well, yeah, I understand partly, but if you ignore the Old Testament, you can't really understand the New Testament because tons of stuff actually points back to Daniel in particular. Daniel contains the gospel. Matthew 24, verses 3 and 4. Now, as Jesus sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, Tell us, when will these things be and what will be the sign of your coming? And of the end of the age. Things, by the way, that Daniel talks a lot about. I drop down to verse 30 to 31. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. Then all the tribes of the earth will mourn when they see the Son of Man doing what? Coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to another. So Jesus, in his Matthew 24 Olivet prophecy, says, Son of Man, clouds of heaven, coming to receive unto himself his saints. What happens after that? Well, we won't read it, but in Matthew 25, there's a parable about the talents, and how the saints are given rulership, depending on how they've done with their talents, rulership in the kingdom, you know. I'll make you ruler over many things because you multiplied your talents by 5 and 10 and so on. So expressing later in this discussion about the coming rule of the saints. And then let's finish with Matthew 25, verses 31 to 34. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, and it'll be on clouds of heaven, by the way, and all the holy angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory in his kingdom. That Daniel talked about, all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. He will set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on his left. And the king will say to those on his right hand, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. So when you look at what Jesus is talking about here in his Matthew 24, 25 Olivet prophecy, he's referring back to Daniel. He says, the Son of Man, clouds of heaven, receives a kingdom, shares that kingdom with his saints, and then they rule forever in the everlasting kingdom. That's Daniel 7, or it's a large chunk at least of Daniel 7. So what Jesus was teaching here wasn't, if you like, brand spanking new. He was adding details and fleshing out what was already a major part of Daniel chapter 7, and of course other places. I'm not going to turn there, but Daniel 9 even tells us when the Son of Man should be expected to come on the earth for his first visit, the first coming of the Lord Jesus. Daniel 9 points us to the first century, right? So that's in the book of Daniel. I'm not going to turn there again, but if you go to 2 Thessalonians 2, no, don't go to 2 Thessalonians 2, but if we went to 2 Thessalonians 2, the Apostle Paul talks about the return of Jesus Christ, the great falling away, and the man of sin being revealed. Guess what? That's based upon Daniel 7, 8, 12, 9 as well, right? So the book of Daniel pops up everywhere. Well, not everywhere, you know what I mean, but pops up all over the place. Book of Daniel is a key book. Book of Daniel, book of Revelation, pretty much got the whole end time chronology figured out for us. Okay, so that's part three then. Part four is picking up and moving on now from where we were last week about the book of Daniel and its prophecy of the end times, the signs of the times that we're in today. And as we look, we can keep open, if we want to keep open, do the scriptures support a European resurrected Roman Empire? Do we see that as we go through these visions, or do we see Islam, Middle Eastern countries, Jerusalem, right? Because there is a tendency for all of us to sort of see the Bible as if it was written by an Englishman or somebody from Baltimore. The Bible's not an American book. Sorry, guys, gals. It's not an American book. It's not a British book.
It's not American-centric.
It's not American-centric. It's not British-centric. It's not European-centric. It's centric, centred on Jerusalem. That's the key city. That's where Jesus Christ is returning. That's the headquarters of the world tomorrow.
York.
So it's not New York or Los Angeles or Birmingham, England, right? So where are we going? Oh, Daniel 7, yeah. We're going to move on now and Daniel to Daniel 7. Which is the vision that Daniel had of the four beasts. Who might they be? When might this be? We'll start by reading verses 1 through 8, just to get the story, the picture. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts, the sort of basic outline. So we had Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2. This is Daniel's dream in chapter 7. It's in the first year of Belshazzar. Belshazzar was the king who saw the writing on the wall. Remember, the hand appeared and wrote many, many tekel upharsin, and the king's knees started knocking, and they had to call for Daniel to explain what it meant. And what it meant was, your time is up, King Belshazzar, and he died that night, and the city was taken over, Babylon was taken over, by the Medes, Darius the Mede, right? So Belshazzar was actually the last king of Babylon, final king. No more kings would come from Babylon because Belshazzar is the last. And we know that because the Bible tells us, right? Which becomes relevant in 5 minutes' time. Daniel spoke, saying, I saw my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion and had an eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off. And it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on two feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. So this lion beast appears to have some sort of a conversion, right? Becomes democratic, one might suggest. And suddenly another beast, a second like a bear. It was raised up on one side and had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and they said thus to it, "Arise, devour much flesh." I think one translation says, gorge yourself. So, I mean, a lion is a predator, right? A bear is a predatory animal. It's not talking here about gazelles and mice, right? These are predators. After this, I looked, verse 6, and there was another like a leopard. Get a predatory animal. Which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads. And dominion was given to it. Four heads. Four rulerships. Four governments. Coalition of four forming the leopard. Just speculating. It's a hint for next week, really. Verse 7. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, decac, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Strange beast, this one, right? It's different. Well, a lion's different from a bear. It's different from a leopard. This is different. What way is it different from all the others? Obviously pretty predatory, since it devours and tramples and stamps on everything it can get near. Notice, by the way, it breaks in pieces. That's decac. That means it pulverizes, smashes, leaves nothing left when it's been uncrossed, right? It had 10 horns. What are the 10 horns? Verse 8. I was considering the horn, says Daniel, and hello, there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes, like the eyes of a man, and a mouth, speaking pompous words, or boastful words. So Daniel's sort of like, my word, what on earth is this creature, right? Which we won't be covering today. That's to bring you back next week. You know, that's what they sort of, you throw up the bait and then reel people in. But looking at it at the moment, if you look at most, you know, Bible prophecy type books or commentaries, what you'll find, I think, by and large, is that this is deemed to be just a repeat of Daniel 2. Daniel 2, you had the statue with a head of gold, you know, Babylon, chest of silver, Persia, belly and thighs, two thighs of bronze, and the iron legs from the knees downwards. Right, and this is just the same. Only rather than using a statue with metals, we've got four beasts. But it's, you know, it's the same sort of thing, basically. It's just repeating in a slightly different set of images the story we saw before. And what we saw before was the days of Nebuchadnezzar, you know, one empire of gold followed by an empire of silver, followed later by, with the statue and the legs going all the way down to Jesus' return. That's what you got here. It's just repeating the story, but with different creatures, right? Now, it is quite likely the case, I don't think this is really speculation, to say that the territories we're talking about are the same. That the head of gold of Babylon is the lion beast, meaning Babylon and, of course, today, Iraq, which, of course, is a Muslim nation. That the chest of silver, being Persia, is the bear over here. Yep, same region. Bear, Persia, Iran is, of course, Muslim. And back in time, we have the bronze sort of belly and thighs, two thighs, of bronze, being a Javan, Greece, the Hellenistic Empire of Alexander, and here the leopard with these four heads is again probably Javan, Asia Minor, Turkey, that region, which of course is also Muslim today. And the Iron Legs are, what are the Iron Legs? Rome? If it is, then of course the Iron Terrible Beast here is Rome. But I've said already, there's not much evidence. Well, actually, there's no evidence, but there's not much evidence for Rome in Scripture. So this fourth beast almost certainly isn't Rome, because how could it be, right? But there's a further problem, right? Because people say this is just recapping the last 2,500 years since the days of ancient Babylon, all the way up to just like the statue. It's not just like the statue. It might be the same four territories, right? But it seems quite evident, turned over too soon, that, the further problem is that the Daniel 7 beasts appear to be all future, not historic, right? Let's look at Daniel 7:17. And I think we're going to have a slide sort of here for you to look at on the screen. Because Daniel 7:17, we have an angel, and put some confidence in angels, right? And the angel says to Daniel in the New King James Version, which is my go-to Bible, "Those great beasts which are four kings which arise out of the earth." Which arise. No comment about when. But actually, many translations make it plain, at least to the translator's satisfaction, the four kings who arise, the four beasts who will arise, it's future. So you've got the King James Version. These are four kings which shall arise. The English Standard Version. These are four kings who shall arise. The New American Standard Bible, which claims to be the most accurate Bible on the earth. New American, so you know what the Americans are like. The New American Standard Bible are four kings who will arise. And if you take the nearly inspired version, are four kings that will rise, right? So many translations bring out that, as far as they're concerned, these four kings, these four beasts, will arise sometime in the future. Now, the Aramaic, and Daniel 7 is still in Aramaic, it doesn't become Hebrew till Daniel 8, the Aramaic is inconclusive. You can't quite tell whether it's present or future, right? But we read earlier, and I stopped at the time to say this was in the reign of Belshazzar. Right? Belshazzar is the last king of Babylon. There aren't any more kings of Babylon. So if the angel says these are four kings who shall arise, it can't be one from Babylon. There weren't any others from Babylon. Belshazzar was the end of the road. That was the end of Babylon. Kaput, right? So four kings who shall arise has to be four kings yet future, after Babylon is gone. Right? So most likely, minor speculation, but most likely Daniel 7's four beasts are all future end time. Same regions, no problem with that. Right? We've identified the regions, but not ancient history recapped yet again for some strange reason. These are end time fulfillments in the end time, right? And that seems to be confirmed if we look at Daniel 7 back up to verse 9, and we read 9 through 12. Daniel 7 and verses 9 through 12. So in Daniel 8, which we just read a moment or two ago, you got the little horn, right, coming out of this fourth terrible, great, terrible beast. Little horn has got eyes and a mouth and speaks pompous and arrogant things. And of course, Daniel later on will find out, is like really curious, who's this little horn? Well, first of all, who's this terrible beast? What is this terrible beast? Never seen anything like it before. Mr. Angel, what is it? And especially, what's that pompous, boastful horn? Who is that? Right? So that's where we are in verse 8, and then in verse 9, Daniel says, "I watched till thrones were put in place," of course you've been here half an hour ago, "and the Ancient of Days was seated," and it's in the time of this fourth beast, right? "His garment was white as snow, his hair was like pure wool, his throne was a fiery flame, its wheels were a burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him, 1,000 thousands ministered to him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated and the books were opened. Now, we don't know what the books are, but you'd have to guess, I think. Is that speculation? You have to guess in context that there are the books, the forensic evidence about this fourth empire and its boastful, arrogant, pompous little horn. Because, context continues, I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. So we haven't left the topic. When the Ancient of Days sits down and the books are opened, it's to do with this fourth beast and the pompous horn. Verse 11, I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. I watched till the beast, the fourth beast, the great and terrible beast, in the context of the Ancient of Days sitting down and the judgment beginning and the books being opened, I watched till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame, which might be the lake of fire. Verse 12, as for the rest of the beasts, the other three, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. They're still there. So if you look at it, Daniel 7:17 says these are four beasts which will arise. Daniel verse 12 there, 11 and 12 there, says that these beasts are contemporaneous. They're all running at the same time. They're all out there at the same time. You know, the fourth one is the great terrible one. That's taken care of. That's destroyed, burned up, what did it say there? And the burning flame, slain, body destroyed. But the other three beasts, the lion, the bear, and the four-headed leopard, their authority is taken away. No more, if you like, military political power. But those empires still continue for a time. So it says there, does it? Not in verse 12. As for the rest of the beasts, the other three, they had their dominion taken away. Yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. So all four beasts are contemporaneous, I'm saying, in the end time. Daniel 7 and its beasts are not just a rehash of 2,500 years of history from ancient Nebuchadnezzar through to Christ's return. They're not. At least that's what I'm suggesting. And that's the reason why. Verse 17, and the fact that all four beasts, I think, are clearly contemporaneous, right? So that's pretty much going to tie us up for today. Next week, we're going to come back to Daniel 7 and look at the four beasts in more detail, especially the fourth beast. I might say that just because if you look at verse 25, just as we wrap up. So Daniel 7, 25, he talking of this arrogant, pompous little horn, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High. And notice, this might involve us. We should be prepared. Shall persecute, or other translations are harass or wear out, the saints of the Most High, shall intend to change times and law. And then, perhaps to our dismay, the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. So the great and terrible fourth beast and his little horn is going to trample all over the saints of the Most High. So if we're saints of the Most High,
you had it.
Will we be facing this beast, do you think, for 3.5 years? Can we find out? Come back next week. Okay, with that, we'll conclude today's Bible study.